This is Donna with your WUSB concert billboard for Monday, May 20th. There's an open mic and jam at KJ Farrell's in Belmore. Corey Henry will be at the Rockwood Music Hall, Stage 2, Manhattan. Your concert billboard for Tuesday, May 21st. Buck Cherry will be at the Emporium in Patchogue. Brian McKnight and the Duke Ellington Orchestra, featuring Brian McKnight, will be at the Blue Note for two shows, 8 and 10 p.m. Wakey Wakey will be at the Rockwood Music Hall, Stage 2, 9:15. Dysfunction will be at Cafe What? Lauren Robert will be at Iridium, 8 p.m. Looking ahead to Wednesday, May 22nd, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy will be at the Bolton Center in Bayshore, 8 p.m.
This has been today's Concert Billboard. Tune in each day to hear when your favorite performers are appearing at venues in the WUSB broadcast area, or maybe try out one you haven't heard before. The online version of the Concert Billboard at WUSB.fm has an upcoming schedule months ahead, so you know what to look forward to. Look for the WUSB Concert Billboard group on Facebook. Concert Billboard is a service of WUSB Stony Brook, 90.1 FM.
And the local time is 2 minutes after six, make that 3 minutes after 6 o'clock, and you are listening to WUSB Stony Brook. Time once again for Off the Wall. Thank you. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you. On this Tuesday evening, the, what is it, 21st of May, really? Well, it feels like the 21st of July outside. And this has been a week. I'll tell you, I've been rung through the ringer myself, but there's so much else going on in the world that makes that so incredibly insignificant. But if I sound a little out of it, it's because the Novocaine is not completely worn off yet. I came from the dentist. I figured it was a good idea to schedule today and get this over with. And for some reason, I always get way too much, I'm numb for hours afterwards. But it's starting to wear off. I might drool a little bit. It might sound like I'm more out of it than I usually am. But, all is well. I also got food poisoning this week. Oh, yeah, that was fun. So, it's been weird. I lost a whole day, and now it's in the mid-80s outside, and over 100 degrees in here, but I'm not going to talk about that. Hey, we had a drug bust here on campus. You hear about this? Yeah, maybe it'll make the national news again. It used to be back in the day, Stony Brook was the center for drug busts, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. But, you know, looking at this, I just heard about this on the way in, actually. A Stony Brook University student from Elmhurst, Queens, has pleaded not guilty to felony drug charges after her dorm room was found with a stash of marijuana, hallucinogens, drug paraphernalia, and $35,000 in cash. I got to tell you, I don't want to keep saying back in the day, because this doesn't even go back in the day. This just goes back not too many days ago, where you put a Pink Floyd poster up on the wall, and that's a normal college student's room. You know, marijuana, hallucinogens, that's part of the college experience. It was, certainly. How do you think you wind up taking all those electives and talking about Nietzsche and Chinese philosophy and all kinds of other things? Well, feed your head indeed. But the one thing that is unusual, though, is $35,000 in cash. That's one thing that did not show up in many college dormitories. But that's interesting. But at least, if there's any good to be shed on this, I would say that I'm not hearing about any really bad drugs like cocaine and heroin and things like that. It seemed like the, those other ones, which I won't say any more about, except that they're legal in some places. All right. And of course, horrible storms in the Midwest, Oklahoma City, suburb of Oklahoma City, leveled last night. Wow. I was actually paying attention to some of the warnings, and I heard about the storm that actually hit after the warnings. 91 people killed, 20 children, and then today I woke up, and the number is 24 people killed and 7 children. Only in America can we do that, you know? Where fate seems to shine down on us and make horrible tragedies less horrible. Or it might just be our inability to keep track of things. But yeah, of course, it's chaotic and absolute mayhem in situations like that. Makes Sandy look like a spring shower. Something we could use right about now. But yeah, tornadoes. Wow, that's like the one thing. I don't know how to deal with that. And in Oklahoma, in many places, apparently they don't have basements. I was hearing that on the news. They don't have basements because it's expensive to make basements. The ground is very hard. And a lot of homes simply don't have them. A lot of schools don't have them. In fact, one of the schools that was destroyed did not have a basement, from what I'm hearing. And that just seems unforgivable that we can live in a country where that's possible. It's Tornado Alley. They literally call it that because so many tornadoes go by. And when you live in a place like that, you damn well better have a basement. Otherwise, just what do you expect to do? Check out some of those pictures. Buildings, all you see is the concrete slab. That's it. Nothing else left. There's no way to survive something like that. Debris blown 22,000 feet up in the air. That's cruising altitude. So, definitely more preparation is needed. There certainly was preparation because so few people died. If you see how massive that particular funnel cloud was. But, we know the risks, we know the science, we can do better. And, we do have the resources, we just have to allocate them in the right way. I don't know if there's any other part of the world where that happens. And I was trying to think about this, and, you hear about all sorts of horrible things going on in other places, and every time something horrible happens in another place, the casualties are always so much greater. You know, we're still reeling over the Boston Marathon bombings, where only, three people died? And there have been so many bombings since then in other cities, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, where hundreds of people have died, and it's just brushed off if it makes the news at all. And there's something seriously wrong with that. Their lives aren't worth any less, but we do think of it that way. We think of it by not paying attention. And in many cases, our actions, ours being our country's actions that we pay for, help set it up. So that there are these factions and fighting and bombings and drones and all sorts of things going on that make the body count go ever higher. And then, of course, you have the natural disasters. You have the cyclones in Bangladesh. I used to think cyclones and tornadoes were the same thing, but they're really not, are they? Cyclone is more like a hurricane. It doesn't help that they call it different things in different parts of the world. But I honestly don't know of another place on this planet that has tornadoes like the Midwest does. And the Deep South. Don't hear about it in South America. I don't hear about it in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, certainly not in Antarctica. In Australia, I haven't heard anything in Australia for a while. What's going on down there? So, it's one thing that I think might be purely American. Tornadoes, wow. Of course, there are tornadoes on other planets. That much has been verified. We've seen pictures of them. And they put these ones to shame. This one, though, is level 5, supposedly. They announced that just a little while ago. And that's the highest. That begins at 200 miles an hour. And I think it goes up to 350 miles an hour. And I believe this one just went over 200 miles an hour. So can you imagine almost double that is possible? I don't know if they even have a category beyond that. I don't think that's ever happened in the history of the planet. But with global warming, I suppose anything is possible. Or should I say climate change? So, yeah, difficult times, difficult week. Crazy things going on. Now, whenever things happen, we always get more details later on. And the details often conflict with the facts as they were presented originally. And sometimes it's not what we want to hear. And it turns out in the in that whole pursuit of the Boston Marathon bombers, remember when they were chasing them all throughout the suburbs of Boston? And apparently that that cop that was shot during that, not the one who was massacred in his car at MIT, not that one. There was another cop who was killed. During all this, apparently he was hit by friendly fire. Wasn't wounded by the people that were being chased. They, in fact, it turns out they only had one handgun. They had a bunch of explosives that they were dropping out of the car that they were fleeing in, and only a few of those even exploded. Not all of them did. But it's being revealed now, police fired nearly 300 rounds of ammunition within 5 to 10 minutes as they confronted the suspects, 100 more than initially reported. And that included one round that nearly killed Massachusetts Transit Police Officer Richard Donahue. And other bullets struck the two brothers who were fleeing. But Tamerlan was the only brother armed with a handgun. The only other weapons they had were the homemade explosives that they tossed out of the hijacked vehicle, including, as I mentioned, a few that detonated. Police accidentally fired on an unoccupied black SUV during the mayhem. In the chaos, an officer or trooper or some combination of personnel mistook it for one of the two suspect vehicles. That's according to the Massachusetts State Police. So, mistakes happen all the time. And I'm not trying to be judgmental here, but it's just something that we have to remember. It's something police have to remember as well. You know, we love to treat cops as if they're superhuman, superheroes, whatever we want to call them. You know, every moment they take their lives, they put them at risk to save us. But many times they're human beings. In fact, all times they're human beings. Beneath all that armor and protection, and they panic sometimes. And we have to recognize that. They have to recognize that. And I think once we start thinking of them as human beings again and not as this impenetrable force, maybe there won't be such a barrier in so many situations. It's bad for both sides, both the civilian side and the law enforcement side, to have such a huge gap. There's another story that that took place here on Long Island over the past few days. Another tragic story of a Hofstra College student. Lived with a bunch of students in a house. The house was invaded by one guy, one maniac, just intruded. Home intruder, I guess is what you call him. And basically, the upshot is that in the mayhem, he and the student were killed. Inhaled gunfire. Now, he basically broke into the house with a gun, and the police responded. After what happened was one of the students was sent away to get money from an ATM. This is how it worked. He knocked on the door. They opened the door, forced his way in. Apparently not enough money in the house, sent somebody out to get more money, and held other people in the house hostage. Yeah, not the brightest of moves, because obviously the person going outside is going to alert the authorities. I think very few people wouldn't do that. But here's what happened. The authorities showed up. And it was pretty obvious. If you know how to read the media or read what is being fed to the media, the fact that nothing was being said about the source of the bullet that killed the college student, nothing was being said about that. That made it pretty obvious that it wasn't the perpetrator's bullet. And sure enough, a few days later, I don't know why it takes so long when they obviously can get these results immediately. Or very close to immediately. The word came out that it was, in fact, a cop that had shot her, obviously accidentally. And again, we're looking at a situation, and we've seen this so many times before, where cops panic. Look what happened, going back to the Boston Marathon case. Look what happened when the brother who was holed up on a boat in someone's backyard was fired upon. You heard the gunfire. It went on for something like 5 minutes. It turned out he didn't have a gun. Now, yeah, I know he's a horrible person. People are very angry at him, but that wasn't justified. And the only reason it happened was because there was bad information. And cops, even the guys with lots and lots of guns, panicked. That is what happens. People panic with guns, without guns. But when you panic with guns, very bad things can happen, as we're seeing. And with every single case that happens, every single incident that we read about, that we hear about, if you're dumb enough like me to scroll down and read the comments in the news stories that for some reason still exist to this day, I don't know how, only the New York Times is able to somehow have intelligent comments, but every other source I've seen has basically the most infantile, absurd, hateful, offensive posts. And oftentimes they are extremely hurtful, especially when tragedy is involved. But there are always these people who will say, well, that wouldn't have happened if the people inside the house had a gun. And you know what? It would have happened. Worse things would have happened. And this proves it, because here you had somebody who was trained with a gun, and he screwed up big time. And again, let's go back to this cops are human theory that I have, and say, yeah, he screwed up, he's human. He panicked. He did the wrong thing. Now, unlike what I'm reading today from the president of the Nassau County Police Benevolent Association, who basically is blindly saying that he's 100% behind this cop, did completely the right thing, did nothing wrong. This is the words of James Carver. And basically this real infantile outburst in the media. There's only one person responsible for what happened early Friday, and that's the ex-con. We get paid to respond quickly and take action. There's some second-guessing going on by people who think maybe we should have stayed outside the house, but our job is to get inside there and make sure we can protect as many people as we can. This PBA stands behind our police officer and the actions he took. Well, you know, at some point, you got to, you know, put down the blind allegiance and admit that a mistake was made, because I'm not a cop. But even I know that you don't run into a house with a hostage and open fire. I've watched enough police dramas in my life to know that much. And yeah, that's the extent of my experience. But anybody with more experience should really be speaking a bit more intelligently and less emotionally about this. He called the shooting a split-second decision that is now being second-guessed and criticized by those who never went to a police academy, never once responded to a call of a man with a gun, putting their lives on the line to protect others. He did the right thing in there. For those who are second-guessing, walk a day in our shoes and see how easy your decisions would have been that day. You know, really, this temper tantrum is inappropriate, because we all know cops have a hard job. But this is why it's hard, because they have to make the hard decisions. And when they make the wrong decisions, they need to stand up and be accountable. And I think everybody will realize this was an accident. This was something that was not meant to happen. The guy is traumatized for doing it. But if we don't say this is wrong and this should not have happened in the first place, then it's just going to keep happening again. And we're going to have poorly trained cops everywhere, as we do now. And you'll see all kinds of overreactions like we see in New York City all the time, where a guy walking backwards in Times Square is mowed down by cops because he was carrying a knife, but walking backwards. You know, things like that. The job is hard. The job is to get out of difficult situations without inflicting casualties, without hurting people, without shooting people. And with this attitude of, well, you know, walk in our shoes, it's not easy. It's not easy in anybody's shoes for various reasons. But yeah, real tragedy there. And again, indication that more guns does not solve the problem at all. And if somebody inside that house had been armed, how quickly do you think they could have run upstairs and gotten it, or found where it was, wherever they hid it in the house, or maybe they had to carry it all the time. Wouldn't have worked out, and probably would have been all kinds of gunfire inside. And when you look at how these things play out lots of times, I just read an excerpt about the Boston Marathon. Was it 300 rounds were fired and 100 hit a particular target? Basically, the amount of rounds that hit the target, even for people who are trained, is relatively low, except on TV. I like it when people send in articles that are meant to prove me wrong, and in fact, only serve to bolster my position. You know, here's a story, and admittedly, it comes from a website called MrConservative.com. I don't even know why I'm reading this, but it's interesting because it serves to illustrate a point. A couple whose names are being withheld by police, that's unusual, were outside of their apartment on Friday in Philadelphia when Jasper Brisbane, who they said appeared to be on drugs, walked up and began staring at them. He did this for several minutes as the couple grew increasingly uncomfortable. Eventually, they decided to go inside their apartment to get away from him, but he followed them. And that's when things really took a turn for the worse. When the man opened the door, Jasper Brisbane pushed his way past them into the apartment. At that point, the man grabbed his AR-15 semi-automatic rifle and told Jasper Brisbane to leave. Brisbane refused his request and started moving towards him in a threatening manner. That's when the man shot him in the chest and sent Brisbane to the ground. Afterwards, the man called police. Although the police are still investigating the incident, it was noted that Brisbane was charged with aggravated assault in December. If the gun grabbers had gotten their way and prevented that couple from owning an AR-15, they'd probably be nothing more than two dead crime statistics today. Instead, they're still alive and walking around while the crazed man who broke into their apartment is no longer here. Thank you, Second Amendment. Thank you. Okay, you know what? I'm not clear from this if he died or what. They say he's no longer here. Does that mean he's just no longer there, or did they really kill him? Okay, so let's start with the simple things. AR-15 semi-automatic rifle. Sounds like you could have done the same thing with a pistol. You know, you didn't need a semi-automatic rifle for this. So right away, it's not proving the point that that kind of weapon is necessary for this kind of bizarre situation, which really doesn't happen all that often. And then you have the fact that this guy wasn't armed, because if he was, I'm sure it would have been mentioned in the story. And while it's not nice to have somebody force their way into your apartment, I don't know if shooting them in the chest is necessarily the right reaction every time. Oh, yeah, you can stand up and shout and say, I have every right to shoot somebody who forces their way into my house. Yeah, fine. Maybe in this country you do. Or maybe in certain states you do. But was your life really in danger? They say here that if it wasn't for that AR-15, they'd be nothing more than two dead crime statistics. How do you figure that? How is this one guy going to kill two people? Now, granted, it's not a good situation. We're faced with bad situations every single day, on the road, in the supermarket, in our own homes, in schools. But violent force isn't always the answer to it. Sometimes there's no other way, and that's a very unfortunate thing. But that should be the rare exception. And this is not the case to prove the point. There may well be cases out there that do prove the point. This isn't it. And, you know, there was an interesting article that appeared on the BBC website over the weekend. Iceland. You may have heard of it. Iceland, the country up between here and Europe. Actually, technically, it's in Europe. They have all kinds of guns. In fact, the article describes them as awash in guns, but it has one of the lowest violent crime rates in the world. Yeah, here's an account by U.S. law student Andrew Clark. Even though I grew up in New England, there was something novel about seeing an Icelandic blizzard. It was paralyzing, with epic wind gusts that made snowflakes feel like razors. As I dragged my bags along Reykjavik's snowy pavement, an older man in a Jeep pulled alongside me. "You want to get in?" he asked. It sounded crazy. Why would I ever get in a stranger's car? Despite everything I was taught about riding in cars with strangers, I climbed in the back seat, and I knew nothing bad was going to happen to me. After all, I was in Iceland for a week to study the nation's lack of crime, my second trip there in 6 months. I guess it would be kind of ironic if you got mugged or something while doing a study on the lack of crime. I spent the last 3 years in Boston at Suffolk University Law School, where I was studying international law. Before my first visit to Reykjavik in August of 2012, my law school thesis was settled, a study of cyber warfare and the Geneva Conventions, but a week in Iceland changed my perspective. I was pleasantly flummoxed by what I saw. Violent crime was virtually non-existent. People seemed relaxed about their safety and that of their children to the point where parents left their babies outside and unattended. Yeah. I'd spent time in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, but those countries now appear plagued with crime by comparison. Probably free of crime by comparison with us. Once I got back to America, I changed my thesis topic. I wanted to know what Iceland was doing right. And there's no perfect answer as to why they have one of the lowest violent crime rates in the world. According to the Global Study on Homicide, which the UN puts out every year, in 2011, it was published that the 10-year rate never went above 1.8 per 100,000 on any given year, and the U.S. is between 5 and 5.8 per 100,000 during that same stretch. There's a fundamental difference of some sort. Now, one of the theories is that there's virtually no difference between upper, middle, and lower classes in Iceland, and with that, tension between economic classes and non-existent, which is a pretty rare occurrence. And crimes in Iceland, when they do occur, usually don't involve firearms, though Icelanders own plenty of guns. Gunpolicy.org estimates there are approximately 90,000 guns in the country, in a country with just over 300,000 people. They rank 15th in the world in terms of legal per capita gun ownership. Acquiring a gun, though, it's not an easy process. Steps to gun ownership include a medical examination and a written test. Police are unarmed, too. Imagine that. The only officers permitted to carry firearms are on a special force called, what else, the Viking Squad, and they're seldom called out. Now, there are also a few hard drugs in Iceland. That could be a contributing factor as well. Use among 15 to 64-year-olds in Iceland of cocaine was 0.9%, ecstasy 0.5%, amphetamines 0.7%. But there's also, and I think this might be the most important thing, there's also a tradition in Iceland of preempting crime issues before they arise, stopping issues at the early stages before they can get worse. So, I'll be the first to admit it's not always just guns. Guns are an epidemic, and they're out of control in this country for sure. But it's the unwillingness of so many to deal with that that adds unimaginable horror to the problem. But there are other issues as well. We have a violent society. We have all kinds of problems that, when factored in with a completely uncontrollable gun culture, makes it so much worse. So, you know, if you really want a good perspective on this, the film Bowling for Columbine by Michael Moore, how many of you have actually watched it? By you, I'm referring to the people who are basically throwing things at the radio right now. And I know you're out there. But he reaches basically the same conclusion. That it's not completely the guns. And I'll bet you didn't know that if you never watched the film. You probably thought it was just a complete condemnation. No, it's not. He compares the United States to Canada, which also has plenty of guns, but not nearly as much violent crime. It's the culture as well. There's so much that has to be changed. Seriously, if you have not watched that film and you've jumped to conclusions about it, do yourself a favor and see what is really said, because there's a lot there that pertains to what's going on today. We didn't talk about this last week at all because I guess we just ran out of time. But that whole crazy story in Ohio where the guy had three abducted women in his home for 10 years or more on a somewhat average Cleveland block. What a story. But, you know, I've noticed some disturbing things coming out of this. And basically, in the comments of a lot of people who live in the area, who say that, well, there was something strange about the house, and the police didn't do their job because they didn't investigate for, and of course they didn't do their job because they didn't investigate certain real things that were going on, like people seen in backyards and strange noises and things like that. Yeah, that's something they should have investigated more. But there seems to be a growing clamor for any suspicious-looking house to be searched, because who knows how many more of these things can happen. And this is the same kind of reaction that we're seeing to the Boston bombings, where surveillance is being hailed as our savior. We need more of it. We need more facial recognition. We need more of all kinds of things to keep us safe. And if someone's suspicious looking, they need to be investigated. And if a house doesn't look right, it needs to be searched. It's all to keep us safe. And these are words that are coming from the people. Not from the evil overlords above us. No, these are coming from the streets. People who are fooled into thinking that pointing out differences and finding strange-looking people, that's the way to weed out crime. And it's basically just the way to spread fear and suspicion. Being observant on a number of levels is the way to find things. And if people had been a bit more observant, I'm sure they would have noticed more. Now, there's also a push because they weren't able to keep track of where the Boston Marathon brothers were traveling to. Now they want to fingerprint any foreigner when they leave the country as well as when they arrive. It's a new system. It's intended to help keep better track of where visitors to the U.S. are coming from and where they're going. And air travelers mostly agree. There's a lot of immigrants that come in, one air traveler said. Once they reach here in the country, they stay here. Even if their visa is expired, once they reach the United States, this is their base. This is their home. Another one said, if the American government feels that this is what's important, they have their intelligence and they know what should be done. I'm not questioning that. I don't have any problem with that. The third one, you have to know who is here, who is not here, when to come, when to go. Meanwhile, a local immigrants' rights advocacy group says about the only effect it will have on people's privacy rights, as well as concerns about selective enforcement, that we don't want to see a situation where only people from particular countries may be fingerprinted or other racial profiling taking place. What I wonder is, how come this isn't an issue in any other country? Can you imagine every time you travel somewhere having to be fingerprinted when you enter and when you leave? It would sort of take all the fun and joy out of traveling, wouldn't it? But we've convinced ourselves that this is now necessary. And then we come to what's certainly the most disturbing story of the week. And that's what happened in New York City over the weekend. And that is the hate crime. The hate crime took place in the West Village, where a gay man was murdered. Literally for walking down the street. Mere blocks away from where the entire gay rights movement started at the Stonewall Inn. Probably heard the story by now. It's been in the media. It's gotten a lot of attention, but I don't think it's gotten enough attention. There was a rally yesterday. Thousands of people showed up in Lower Manhattan. And basically, they were there to pay tribute. The 32-year-old Mark Carson lived in Greenwich Village. Actually, he died in Greenwich Village. I believe he lived in Brooklyn. He was killed Saturday as he walked with a companion through the village. And they say a man charged with murder as a hate crime shot him in the head in the heart of one of the city's most progressive neighborhoods. And what's even more disturbing, if it can get any more disturbing than this, is the fact that this is not an isolated incident. It's the only incident so far where somebody has been killed. But there have been other incidents before this by Madison Square Garden after a Knick game outside a pool hall uptown. Bias-related crimes have risen to 22 from 13 during the same period last year. And, you know, this is an interesting point because many people bring this up. They don't understand why we need to have something called a hate crime, why that's important. Obviously, if somebody kills you, they hate you. Obviously, if somebody attacks you, that's a crime. Isn't that enough? No, it's not enough. And this shows why it's not enough. Because any one of us walking outside of our homes runs the risk of something violent happening to us. We've accepted this risk. It's part of our culture. It's part of living in today's society. We could get mugged. We could get jumped. We could even get shot. It's possible. It's a risk we all accept whenever we walk down the street. We live with it. But when that risk is exacerbated by who you are, when every moment you walk down the street, you're a target because of who you are, whether you're black, whether you're gay, whether you're Arab, regardless, it's who you are. And if that is enough to make you more of a target than anybody else, that's a special kind of hell that I don't think a lot of people really understand. And it's that fear. And you'll see that fear now. You'll see it in the heart of the West Village, which is probably the most gay-friendly neighborhood in the country. San Francisco can battle it out. I don't know. But you see that fear now. Can people hold hands? Will they be targeted? And we've seen that fear before. And we still see it to this day. Of different races, different religions. And so when you're afraid to be who you are, it's a very different kind of a risk than that which we all accept when we walk outside that door. So when you become a victim of a crime, based on that, it is, yeah, it's worse. Because it's not a random thing, it's a targeted thing. It's something you can't change about yourself, but yet you have to carry that extra bit of fear. Now, of course, the question that's asked afterwards, well, can't hate crimes be perpetrated against anybody then? And yeah, of course, it's possible, but, you know, it's a lot less likely when you're part of the majority in this country. And, of course, I'm referring to the angry white males, which usually ask me these questions. Yeah, you might find yourself outnumbered in certain situations, in certain neighborhoods. in certain areas, certain situations. Yeah, it's possible. But you won't live every moment of your life in that situation. And there is nobody among us who can imagine what that is like if you are not actually part of one of the groups in question. In other words, if you're white, you have absolutely no idea what it's like to grow up black in this country. You can theorize, you can watch documentaries, you can read books, and you can sympathize all you want, but you will never know. You will never feel that. And without feeling that, you can't appreciate what that does to the way that you live your life and how you have to put on masks and be different and be on guard. So, yeah, you know, when a hate crime takes place, it needs to be noted. It needs to be different than just random violence, because it is different than random violence. But, you know, this brings the issue into the forefront, which I guess is a good thing. It does need to be confronted, and it's not going to be easy, because even after this, there have been more instances. Today, there are more instances. First off, this lunatic who did this, according to the Daily News, and I got to say, you know, reading the Daily News' accounts of this, I don't usually read them, but yeah, they've changed. We've changed in many ways, many positive ways. We talk about this all the time. And the Daily News basically referred to him as the homophobe accused of shooting a gay man to death in the West Village, laughed in hideous glee as he confessed. That's according to a prosecutor who said this to a judge on Sunday. He's not the only one. Mere hours after a 1,000-strong march through the West Village to protest the shooting death of 33-year-old Mark Carson, two more suspected gay bashings occurred in Manhattan. In one instance, a Hispanic couple was attacked in Soho while being called anti-gay epithets. Two men were arrested and charged with a hate crime. But that wasn't it. In Alphabet City, party promoter Dan Contarino was beaten in what is being investigated as another bias attack. He wrote on his Facebook page, "This is just as brutal as the attack. 3 hours, 8 detective interviews, now waiting for hate crimes unit main interview, then back to the hospital." But he was appreciative for the calls and the concern. And it's hard to imagine what is up, what's going on, where is this coming from? Especially here, especially in New York, where, as I said, you know, it all started back in the 60s. That's when the gay rights movement started. And to see this happening again, it just fills people with rage. That no, we're not going to be dragged back to the 1980s or the period before then, where this kind of thing was a lot more common. We're not going to let that happen. June is Gay Pride Month. I imagine it'll be a vocal one. And I imagine this topic is going to be brought up in many, many places, as it should be. It's time we confronted this. It's time we were firm in saying no more of this. Stupidity is raising its ugly head yet again. And I certainly thought we were past it. Certainly in New York, in our city, our state, even our country. You know, it takes a while. But I feel like we've made progress. And I believe that does count for something. But we need to forcefully fight back against this kind of ignorance. And it doesn't just take place in violent encounters. It takes place in verbal encounters as well. It takes place in the ignorance that we see around us every single day. In the little comments made under people's breath, in the way people inside your family, your friends, might treat others, whether to their face or behind their backs. It's time that we simply laid it all out on the table. You know, if you have a kid who comes out to you and you have a problem with that, it makes you uncomfortable. There's something wrong with you. If you have a friend who is gay and it makes you uncomfortable, there's something wrong with you. You need to deal with that. There's not anything wrong with them. In fact, especially if you have a kid who comes to you and says that, feeling anything less than pride for actually having the guts and the honesty to bare their soul like that. I mean, kids have trouble saying they don't want to take piano lessons anymore, to come to one of their parents or both of their parents and say something so personal, life-changing. It's a sign of trust like no other. And it's time we stopped acting like idiots and started accepting and realizing that this is part of life, part of humanity, always has been, always will be. Hate to deal with stupidity again, but it needs to be dealt with, and it's going to be dealt with. And I imagine that there'll be many more such instances to deal with and to talk about. And it's also incumbent on us to have the dialogue, to listen, to not be condemning of people who don't quite get it yet. Because societies, cultures change over the years, over the decades, over the centuries. Your grandparents aren't going to have the same values as your parents, and they won't have the same values as you and your kids, God knows. Which is why we never walk away completely. We never turn our backs and say, I'm just not going to talk to you anymore. Because people do change. People do listen. They do hear. But only if we keep talking. Unfortunately, I kept talking way too long again. It's time to go. I don't know where the time goes. But I will try to open up the phones next week. If you want to write and say whatever is on your mind, and really, say whatever is on your mind, our email address is otw@2600.com. We always love to hear from our listeners. Agree, disagree, value, hate, whatever. Well, try not to hate. We'll see. otw@2600.com. This is Emmanuel for Off the Wall. Have yourselves a good week. Good night. Liberation.
This is Donna with your WUSB Concert Billboard for...